and found. Without identifying myself, I began chatting about maybe redoing a bathroom, maybe getting new tiles. Not too hard to steer the conversation to the killings. I suppose a lot of people have been rethinking their home security lately, I suggested.
That's a fact, ma'am. We've had a run on chain locks and double bolts in the past few days, said the grumbly voice.
Really? How many have you gone through?
About 3 dozen, I'd guess.
Mostly families? People with children?
Oh, yeah. They're the ones got reason to worry, right? Horrible thing. We're hoping to make some sort of donation to little Natalie's family.
He paused.
You want to come down, look at some tile samples?
I might just do that, thanks. One more reporting chore off my list, and I didn't even have to subject myself to name-calling from a grieving mother. For our dinner meeting, Richard picked Gritty's, a family restaurant with a salad bar that featured every kind of food but salad. The lettuce always sat in a small container at the end, a greasy, pale afterthought. Richard was chatting up the jolly fat hostess when I flustered in, 12 minutes late. The girl, whose face matched the pies revolving in the case behind her, didn't seem to notice me hovering. She was immersed in the possibilities of Richard. In her head, she was already writing her diary entry for the night.
"Preaker," he said, eyes still on the girl. "Your tardiness is a scandal. Your lucky Joanne was here to keep me company."
The girl giggled, then glared at me, leading us to a corner booth where she slapped a greasy menu in front of me. On the table, I could still see the outline of the previous customer's glassware. The waitress appeared, slid me a glass of water the size of a shot, then handed Richard a styrofoam trough of soda pop.
"Hey, Richard. I remembered, see? That's why you're my favorite waitress, Kathy."
Cute.
"Hi, Camille. I heard you were in town."
I didn't want to hear that phrase ever again. The waitress, upon second look, was a former classmate of mine. We'd been friends for a semester's sophomore year because we dated best buddies. Mine was Phil, hers was Jerry. Jock guys who played football in the fall and wrestled in the winter and threw parties year-round in Phil's basement rec room. I had a flash memory of us holding hands for balance while we peed in the snow just outside the sliding glass doors, too drunk to face his mom upstairs. I remember her telling me about having sex with Jerry on the pool table, which explained why the felt was sticky.
"Hey, Kathy, it's good to see you. How's it going?"
She threw her arms out and cast a glance around the restaurant.
"Oh, you can probably guess. But hey, that's what you get for sticking around here, right? Bobby says hi. Kidder."
"Oh, right. God." I'd forgotten they got married. "How is he?"
"Same old Bobby. You should drop by sometime, if you have time. We're over on Fisher."
I could picture the clock ticking loudly as I sat in the living room of Bobby and Kathy Kidder, trying to come up with something to say. Kathy would do all the talking. She always had. She was the kind of person who'd read street signs aloud rather than suffer silence. If he was still the same old Bobby, he was quiet but affable, a guy with few interests and slate-blue eyes that flicked into focus only when talk turned to hunting. Back in high school, he saved the hooves of all the deer he killed, always had the latest pair in his pocket, and would pull them out and tap drum beats with them on whatever hard surface was available. I always felt like it was the dead deer's Morse code, a delayed mayday from tomorrow's venison.
"Anyway, you guys doing the buffet?"
I asked for a beer, which brought forth a mighty pause. Kathy glanced back over her shoulder at the clock on the wall.
We're not supposed to serve till 8. But I'll see if I can sneak you one. Old time's sake, right?"
"Well, I don't want to get you in trouble."
Just like Wind Gap to have arbitrary drinking rules. 5 o'clock would make sense, at least. 8 o'clock was just someone's way of making you feel guilty. Lord, Camille, it'd be the most interesting thing that's happened to me in quite a while. While Kathy went to purloin me a drink, Richard and I filled plates with chicken fried steak, grits, mashed potatoes, and in Richard's case, a jiggly slab of jello that was melting into his food by the time we returned to our table. Kathy had left a bottle of beer discreetly on my seat cushion.
Always drink this early?
I'm just having a beer.
I could smell liquor on your breath when you came in, underneath a layer of certs. Wintergreen?
He smiled at me as if he were simply curious, no judgments. I bet he glowed in the interrogation room. Certs, yes. Liquor, no. In truth, that's why I'd been late. Right before I pulled into the parking lot, I realized the quick nip I took after leaving the Keens needed some quick covering up and drove another few blocks to the convenience store to buy some mints. Wintergreen.
Okay, Camille, he said gently. No worries. It's none of my business.
He took a bite of mashed potatoes, dyed red from the jello, and stayed silent. Seemed slightly abashed.
So, what do you want to know about Windgap?
I felt I'd disappointed him keenly, like I was a careless parent reneging on a birthday promise to take him to the zoo. I was willing to tell him the truth then, to answer unfailingly the next question he asked in order to make it up to him, and I suddenly wondered if that was the reason he'd challenged my drinking to begin with. Smart cop.
He stared me down. I want to know about its violence. Every place has its own particular strain. Is it in the open? Is it hidden? Is it committed as a group? Bar fights? Gang rapes? Or is it specific, personal? Who commits it? Who's the target?
Well, I don't know that I can just make a sweeping statement of the entire history of violence here.
Name a truly violent incident you saw growing up.
My mother with the baby. I saw a woman hurt a child.
Spanking? Hitting?
She bit it.
Okay. Boy or girl?
Girl, I think.
The child was hers?
No.
Okay, this is good. So, a very personal act of violence on a female child. Who committed it? I'll check it out.
I don't know the person's name. It was someone's relative from out of town.
Well, who would know her name? I mean, if she has ties here, it'd be worth looking into.
I could feel my limbs disconnecting, floating nearby like driftwood on an oily lake. I pressed my fingertips against my fork tines. Just saying the story aloud panicked me. I hadn't even thought Richard might want specifics.
Hey, I thought this was just supposed to be a profile of violence, I said, my voice hollow behind the blood in my ears. I don't have any details. It was a woman I didn't recognize, and I don't know who she was with. I just assumed she was from out of town.
I thought reporters didn't assume. He was smiling again. I wasn't a reporter at the time. I was only a girl.
Camille, I'm giving you a hard time. I'm sorry.
He plucked the fork from my fingers, placed it deliberately on his side of the table, picked my hand up, and kissed it. I could see the word lipstick crawling out from my right shirt sleeve.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to grill you. I was playing bad cop.
I find it difficult to see you as bad cop. He grinned.
True. It's a stretch. Curse these boyish good looks.
We sipped our drinks for a second. He twirled the salt shaker and said,
Can I ask a few more questions?
I nodded.
What's the next incident you can think of?
The overpowering smell of the tuna salad on my plate was making my stomach twist. I looked for Kathy to get another beer. Fifth grade. Two boys cornered a girl at recess and had her put a stick inside herself.
Against her will? They forced her?
A little bit, I guess.
There were bullies. They told her to, and she did.
And you saw this or heard about it?
They told a few of us to watch. When the teacher found out, we had to apologize.
To the girl?
No. The girl had to apologize, too, to the class. Young ladies must be in control of their bodies because boys are not.
Jesus. You forget sometimes how different things were, and not that many years ago. How just uninformed.
Richard jotted in his notebook, slid some jello down his throat.
What else do you remember?
Once, an eighth-grade girl got drunk at a high school party, and four or five guys on the football team had sex with her. Kind of passed her around.
Does that count? Camille, of course it counts. You know that, right?
Well, I just didn't know if that counted as outright violence or...
Yeah, I'd count a bunch of punks raping a 13-year-old outright violence. Yes, I sure would.
How is everything?
Kathy was suddenly smiling over us.
You think you could sneak me one more beer?
Two, Richard said.
All right. This one I do only as a favor to Richard, since he's the best tipper in town.
Thanks, Kathy. Richard smiled. I leaned across the table. I'm not arguing that it's wrong, Richard. I'm just trying to get your criteria for violence.
Right. And I'm getting a good picture of exactly the kind of violence we're dealing with here, just by the fact that you're asking me if that counts.
Were the police notified?
Of course not.
I'm surprised she wasn't made to apologize for allowing them to rape her in the first place.
Eighth grade. That makes me sick.
He tried to take my hand again, but I tucked it away in my lap. So, it's the age that makes it rape?
It'd be rape at any age.
If I got a little too drunk tonight and was out of my head and had sex with four guys, that would be rape?
Legally, I don't know. It'd depend on a lot of things, like your attorney. But ethically, hell yes.
You're sexist.
What?
You're sexist. I'm so sick of liberal lefty men practicing sexual discrimination under the guise of protecting women against sexual discrimination.
I can assure you I am doing nothing of the sort.
I have a guy in my office. Sensitive. When I got passed over for a promotion, he suggested I sue for discrimination. I wasn't discriminated against. I was a mediocre reporter. And sometimes drunk women aren't raped. They just make stupid choices. And to say we deserve special treatment when we're drunk because we're women, to say we need to be looked after, I find offensive.
Kathy came back with our beers, and we sipped in silence until they were drained.
Geez, Preaker. Okay, I give.
Okay.
You do see a pattern, though, right? In the attacks on females? In the attitude about the attacks?
Except, neither the Nash or Keene girl was sexually molested, right?
I think in our guy's mind, the teeth pulling is equivalent to rape. That's all about power. It's invasive, it requires a goodly amount of force, and as each tooth comes out, release.
Is this on record?
If I see this in your paper, if I see even a hint of this conversation under your byline, you and I will never speak again. And that would be really bad, because I like talking to you.
Cheers. Richard clicked his empty against mine. I stayed silent.
In fact, let me take you out, he said. Just for fun. No shop talk. My brain desperately needs a night off from this stuff. We could do something appropriately small town.
I raised my eyebrows.
Pull taffy? Catch a greased pig?
He began ticking activities on his fingers.
Make our own ice cream? Ride down Main Street in one of those little Shriners cars? Oh, is there a quaint county fair anywhere near here? I could perform a feat of strength for you.
That attitude must really endear you to the locals.
Kathy likes me. Because you're tipper.
We ended up at Garrett Park, jammed on swings that were too small for us, wobbling back and forth in the hot evening dust. The place Natalie Keene was last seen alive, but neither of us mentioned it. Across the ballpark, an old stone drinking fountain spurted water endlessly. Would never go off until Labor Day.
"I see a lot of high school kids partying here at nighttime," Richard said. "Vickery's too busy these days to chase them off."
It was like that even when I was in high school. Drinking's not that big a deal down here, except apparently at Gritty's.
I'd like to have seen you at 16. Let me guess. You were like the wild preacher's daughter. Looks, money, and a brain. That's a recipe for trouble around here, I'd guess.
I can picture you right over there, he said, pointing to the cracked bleachers.
Out drinking the boys.
The least of the outrages I'd committed in this park. Not only my first kiss, but my first blowjob at age 13. A senior on the baseball team took me under his wing, then took me into the woods. He wouldn't kiss me until I serviced him. Then he wouldn't kiss me because of where my mouth had been. Young love. Not long after that was my wild night at the football party, the story that had gotten Richard so riled. Eighth grade, four guys. Got more action then than I've had in the past 10 years. I felt the word wicked blaze up by my pelvis.
I had my share of fun, I said.
Looks and money get you a long way in Wind Gap.
And brains?
Brains you hide. I had a lot of friends, but no one I was close to, you know.
I can imagine. Were you close to your mom?
Not particularly. I'd had one too many drinks. My face felt closed and hot.
Why?
Richard twisted his swing to face me. I just think some women aren't made to be mothers. And some women aren't made to be daughters.
Did she ever hurt you?
The question unnerved me, particularly after our dinner conversation. Hadn't she hurt me? I felt sure someday I'd dream a memory of her, scratching or biting or pinching. I felt like that had happened. I pictured myself pulling off my blouse to show him my scars, screaming, "Yes, look." Indulgent.
That's a bizarre question, Richard.
I'm sorry, you just sounded so sad, mad, something. That's the mark of someone who has a healthy relationship with his parents.
Guilty, he laughed. What about I change the subject?
Yes.
Okay, let's see. Light conversation. Swing set conversation.
Richard scrunched his face up to mime thinking.
Okay, so what's your favorite color, your favorite ice cream flavor, and your favorite season?
Blue, coffee, and winter.
Winter? No one likes winter.
It gets dark early. I like that.
Why?
Because that means the day has ended. I like checking days off a calendar. 151 days crossed and nothing truly horrible has happened. 152 and the world isn't ruined. 153 and I haven't destroyed anyone. 154 and no one really hates me. Sometimes I think I won't ever feel safe until I can count my last days on one hand. 3 more days to get through until I don't have to worry about life anymore. I just like the night. I was about to say more, not much more, but more, when a broken-down yellow IROC rumbled to a stop across the street, and Emma and her blondes piled out the back. Emma leaned into the driver's window, cleavage teasing the boy, who had the long, greasy, dirt-blonde hair you'd expect of someone who still drove a yellow IROC. The 3 girls stood behind her, hips jutted out, the tallest turning her ass to them and bending over, lean and long to pretend to tie her shoe.
Nice moves.
The girls glided toward us, Amma waving her hands extravagantly in protest of the black exhaust cloud. They were hot little things, I had to admit. Long blonde hair, heart-shaped faces, and skinny legs. Mini skirts with tiny tees exposing flat baby tummies. And except for the girl Jodes, whose bosom was too high and stiff to be anything but padding, the rest had breasts, full and wobbly and way overripe. All those milk-fed, hog-fed, beef-fed early years, all those extra hormones we put in our livestock, we'll be seeing toddlers with tits before long.
"Hey, Dick,"
Amma called. She was sucking on a red, oversized blow-pop.
"Hi, ladies."
"Hi, Camille. Make me a star yet?"
Amma asked, rolling her tongue around the sucker. The Alps-inspired braids were gone, as were the clothes she'd worn to the plant, which had to reek with odors of all kinds and species. Now she wore a tank and a skirt that passed her crotch by an inch.
"Not yet."
She had peach skin, so free of blotches or wrinkles, her face so perfect and character-free, she could have just popped out of the womb. They all seemed unfinished. I wanted them to go away.
"Dick, when are you going to take us for a ride?"
Amma asked, plopping down in the dirt in front of us, her legs pulled up to reveal a glimpse of her panties.
"To do that, I'd have to arrest you. I might have to arrest those boys you keep hanging around with. High school boys are too old for you."
"They're not in high school," said the tall girl.
"Yeah," Amma giggled.
"They dropped out."
"Amma, how old are you?" Richard asked.
"Just turned 13.
"Why do you always care so much about Amma?" interrupted the brassy blonde. "We're here, too, you know. You probably don't even know our names."
"Camille, have you met Kylie, Kelsey, and Kelsey?" Richard said, pointing to the tall girl, the brassy girl, and the girl my sister called.
"That's Jodes," Amma said. "There are two Kelseys, so she goes by her last name, to avoid confusion. Right, Jodes?"
"They can call me Kelsey if they want," said the girl, whose low spot in the pecking order was likely punishment for being the least of the beauties. Weak chin.
"And Amma is your half-sister, right?" Richard continued. "I'm not as out of the loop as all that."
"No, it looks like you're right in the loop," Amma said.
She made the words sound sexual, even though I could think of no double entendre.
"So, are you guys dating or what? I heard little Camille here is a real hot ticket. At least she was."
Richard let out a burp of a laugh, a shocked croak. "Unworthy" flared up my leg.
"It's true, Richard. I was something back in the day."
"Something," Amma mocked.
The two girls laughed. Jodes drew frantic lines in the dirt with a stick.
"You should hear the stories, Dick. They'd get you pretty hot. Or maybe you already have."
"Ladies, we've got to be going, but as always, it was definitely something," Richard said, and took my hand to help me out of the swing.
Held on to it, squeezed it twice as we walked toward the car.
"Isn't he a gentleman?"
Amma called, and the four got to their feet and began following us.
"Can't solve crime, but he can take the time to help Camille into his crappy-ass car."
They were right on us, Amma and Kylie stepping on our heels, literally. I could feel sickly, glowing where Amma's sandal had scuffed my Achilles tendon. Then she took her wet sucker and twirled it in my hair.
"Stop it," I muttered.
I twirled around and grabbed her wrist so hard I could feel her pulse. Slower than mine. She didn't squirm. In fact, just pushed closer into me. I could feel her strawberry breath fill the hollow of my neck.
"Come on, do something," Amma smiled. "You could kill me right now and Dick still wouldn't be able to figure it out."
I let go, pushed her away from me, and Richard and I shuffled to the car faster than I would have liked.
Chapter 9. I fell asleep, accidentally and hard, at 9 o'clock, woke to an angry sun at 7 the next morning. A dried-out tree rustled its branches against my window screen, as if it wanted to climb in next to me for comfort. I donned my uniform, the long sleeves, the long skirt, and wandered downstairs. Gayla was glowing in the backyard, her white nurse's dress brilliant against the greenery. She held a silver tray on which my mother was placing imperfect roses. My mother wore a butter-colored sundress that matched her hair. She was stalking through the clumps of pink and yellow blooms with a pair of pliers. She examined each flower hungrily, plucking off petals, pushing and prying.
"You need to water these, Ma Gayla. Look what you've done to them."
She separated a light pink rose from a bush, pulled it to the ground, secured it with a dainty foot, and clipped it off at its root. Gayla must have had 2 dozen roses on her tray. I could see little wrong with them.
"Camille, you and I are going shopping in Woodbury today," my mother called without looking up. "Shall we?"
My mother said nothing about the square-off at the Nashes the day before. That would be too direct. "I have a few things to do," I said. "By the way, I didn't know you were friends with the Nashes, with Anne." I had a catch of guilt for my taunting her about the girl at breakfast the other morning. It wasn't that I truly felt bad that I'd upset my mother. It was more that I hated any debits in her column.
"Mm-hmm. Alan and I are having a party next Saturday. It was planned long before we knew you were coming, although I suppose we didn't really know you were coming until you were here."
Another rose snapped off. "I thought you barely knew the girls. I didn't realize..."
"Fine. It will be a nice summer party. A lot of really fine people, and you'll need a dress. I'm sure you didn't bring a dress."
"No."
"Good, then. It will be a nice chance for us to catch up. You've been here over a week. I think it's time."
She placed a final stem on the tray.
"Okay, Gayla, you can throw these away. We'll pick some decent ones for the house later."
"I'll take those for my room, Mama. They look fine to me."
"They're not."
"I don't mind.
Camille, I was just looking at them, and they're not good blooms."
She dropped the pliers to the ground, began tugging at a stem. "But they're fine for me, for my room."
"Oh, now, look what you've done. I'm bleeding."
My mother held up thorn-pricked hands, and trails of deep red began to roll down her wrists. End of conversation. She walked toward the house, Gayla following her, me following Gayla. The back door knob was sticky with blood. Alan bandaged both my mother's hands extravagantly, and when we nearly tumbled over Emma, working again on her dollhouse on the porch, Adora plucked teasingly at her braid and told her to come with us. She followed obligingly, and I kept waiting for those nicks at my heels. Not with Mother around. Adora wanted me to drive her baby blue convertible to Woodbury, which boasted 2 high-end boutiques, but she didn't want the top down.
"We get cold," she said with a conspiratorial smile at Emma.
The girl sat silently behind my mother, twisted her mouth into a smart-ass smile when I caught her staring at me in the rear view. Every few minutes, she'd brush her fingertips against my mother's hair, lightly, so she wouldn't notice. As I parked the Mercedes outside her favorite shop, Adora requested weakly that I open the car door for her. It was the first thing she'd said to me in 20 minutes. Nice to catch up. I opened the boutique's door for her, too, and the feminine bell matched the saleswoman's delighted greeting.
"Adora!"
And then a frown.
"My goodness, darling, what's happened to your hands?"
"Just an accident, really. Doing some work around the house. I'll see my doctor this afternoon."
Of course she would. She'd go for a paper cut.
"What happened?"
"Oh, I really don't want to talk about it. I do want to introduce you to my daughter, Camille. She's visiting."
The saleswoman looked at Emma, then gave me a wavering smile.
Camille?
A quick recovery.
I think I'd forgotten that you have a third daughter.
She lowered her voice on the word daughter as if it were an oath.
She must take after her father,
the woman said, peering into my face as if I were a horse she might buy.
Emma looks so much like you, and Marion, too, in your pictures. This one, though.
She doesn't take after me much, my mother said. She has her father's coloring and his cheekbones, and his temperament. It was the most I'd ever heard my mother say about my father. I wondered how many other sales ladies had received such casual tidbits about him. I had a quick vision of chatting up all the store clerks in southern Missouri, putting together a blurry profile of the man. My mother petted my hair with gauzy hands.
We need to get my sweetheart a new dress. Something colorful. She's prone to blacks and grays. Size 4.
The woman, so thin her hip bones poked from her skirt like antlers, started weaving in and out of the circular racks, creating a bouquet of splashy green and blue and pink dresses.
This would look beautiful on you,
Emma said, holding a glittery gold top to my mother.
Stop it, Emma,
my mother said.
That's tacky.
Do I really remind you of my father? I couldn't help asking Adora. I could feel my cheeks get hot at my presumptuousness.
I knew you wouldn't just let that go, she said,
touching up her lipstick in a store mirror. The gauze on her hands remained impossibly unsmeared.
I was just curious.
I'd never heard you say my personality reminded you of...
Your personality reminds me of someone very unlike me. And you certainly don't take after Alan, so I assume it must be your father. Now, no more.
But, Mama, I just wanted to know, Camille, you're making me bleed more. She held up her bandaged hands, now pucked with red. I wanted to scratch her. The saleslady bumped up on us with a swatch of dresses.
This is the one you're absolutely gonna have to have, she said,
holding up a turquoise sundress, strapless.
And what about Sweetie Pie here?
The woman said, nodding at Emma.
She can probably already fit into our petites. Emma's only 13. She's not ready for these types of clothes, my mother said. Only 13? Good God! I keep forgetting she looks like such a big girl. You must be worried sick with all that's going on in Wind Gap now.
My mother put an arm around Emma, kissed the top of her head.
Some days I think I won't be able to take the worry. I want to lock her away somewhere. Like Bluebeard's dead wives,
Emma mumbled.
Like Rapunzel, my mother said. Well, go on, Camille. Show your sister how pretty you can be.
She trailed me into the dressing area, silent and righteous. In the little mirrored room, with my mother perched on a chair outside, I surveyed my options. Strapless, spaghetti straps, capped sleeves. My mother was punishing me. I found a pink dress with three-quarter sleeves and, quickly doffing my pants and shirt, pulled it on. The neckline was lower than I'd thought. The words on my chest looked swollen in the fluorescent light, like worms tunneled beneath my skin. Whine, milk, hurt, bleed.
Camille, let me see.
This won't work.
Let me see.
Belittle burned on my right hip. Let me try another. I rifled through the other dresses, all just as revealing. I caught sight of myself again in the mirror. I was horrifying.
Camille, open the door. What's wrong with Camille?
Emma chimed. This won't work. The side zipper was sticking. My bared arms flashed scars in deep pink and purple. Even without looking directly in the mirror, I could see them reflected at me, a big blur of scorched skin.
Camille,
my mother spat.
Why won't she just show us?
Camille.
Mama, you saw the dresses. You know why they won't work, I urged.
Just let me see. I'll try one on, Mama,
Emma wheedled.
Camille.
Fine. I banged open the door. My mother, her face level with my neckline, winced.
Oh, dear God.
I could feel her breath on me. She held up a bandaged hand as if about to touch my chest, then let it drop. Behind her, Emma whined like a puppy.
Look what you've done to yourself,
Adora said.
Look at it.
I do.
I hope you just loved it. I hope you can stand yourself.
She shut the door, and I ripped at the dress. The zipper still jammed until my furious tugs yanked the teeth apart enough to get it to my hips, where I wriggled out, the zipper leaving a trail of pink scratches on my skin. I bunched the cotton of the dress over my mouth and screamed. I could hear my mother's measured voice in the other room. When I came out, the saleswoman was wrapping a long-sleeved, high-collared lace blouse and a coral skirt that would come to my ankles. Emma stared at me, her eyes pink and darting, before leaving to stand by the car outside. Back at the house, I trailed Adora into the entryway, where Alan stood in a falsely casual pose, hands stuffed into his linen trouser pockets. She fluttered past him toward the stairs.
How was your day out? He called after her.
Horrible,
my mother whimpered. Upstairs, I heard her door close. Alan frowned at me and went to tend to my mother. Emma had already disappeared. I walked into the kitchen to the cutlery drawer. I wanted to just look at the knives I once used on myself. I wasn't going to cut, just allow myself that sharp pressure. I could already feel the knife point gently pressing against the plump pads of my fingertips, that delicate tension right before the cut. The drawer pulled out only an inch and then jammed. My mother had padlocked it. I pulled again and again. I could hear the silvery clink of all those blades sliding onto each other, like petulant metal fish. My skin was hot. I was about to go call Curry when the doorbell insinuated itself with its polite tones. Peering around the corner, I could see Meredith Wheeler and John Keane standing outside. I felt like I'd been caught masturbating. Chewing the inside of my mouth, I opened the door. Meredith rolled in, assaying the rooms, letting out minty exclamations of how beautiful everything was, and sending off waves of a dark perfume more suited to a society matron than a teenage girl in a green and white cheerleading outfit. She caught me looking.
I know, school days are over. This is my last time to wear this, actually. We're having a cheer session with next year's girls. It's sort of a torch-passing thing. You were a cheerleader, right?
I was, if you can believe that. I hadn't been particularly good, but I looked nice in the skirt, back in the days when I limited my cutting to my torso.
I can believe it. You were the prettiest girl in the entire town. My cousin was a freshman when you were a senior, Dan Wheeler. He was always talking about you. Pretty and smart, and nice. He'd kill me if he knew I was telling you this. He lives in Springfield now, but he's not married.
Her wheedling tone reminded me of just the kind of girls I was never comfortable with. The types who peddled a sort of plastic chumminess, who told me things about themselves only friends should know, who described themselves as people persons.
This is John,
she said, as if surprised to see him beside her. My first time seeing him up close. He was truly beautiful, almost androgynous, tall and slim with obscenely full lips and ice-colored eyes. He tucked a shock of black hair behind his ear and smiled at his hand as he held it out to me, as if it were a beloved pet performing a new trick.
So, where do you guys want to talk?
Meredith asked. I debated for a second about ridding myself of the girl, worried she might not know when or how to shut up. But he seemed in need of company, and I didn't want to scare him off.
You guys grab a seat in the living room, I said. I'll get us some sweet tea.
I first bounded up the stairs, slammed a new cassette into my mini-recorder, and listened at my mother's door. Silence, except for the whir of a fan. Was she sleeping? If so, was Alan curled up next to her, or perched on her vanity chair just watching? Even after all this time, I hadn't even a guess as to the private life of Adora and her husband. Walking past Emma's room, I saw her sitting very properly on the edge of a rocking chair, reading a book called Greek Goddesses. Since I'd been here, she'd played at being Joan of Arc and Bluebeard's wife and Princess Diana. All martyrs, I realized. She'd find even unhealthier role models among the goddesses. I left her to it. In the kitchen, I poured out the drinks. Then, counting out a full 10 seconds, I pressed the tines of a fork into the palm of my hand. My skin began to quiet down. I entered the living room to see Meredith with her legs dangled over John's lap, kissing his neck. When I clanked the tea tray down on a table, she didn't stop. John looked at me and peeled himself slowly away.
"You're no fun today," she pouted.
"So, John, I'm really glad you decided to talk to me," I began. "I know your mom has been reluctant."
"Yes. She doesn't want to talk to much of anyone, but especially not press. She's very private."
"But you're okay with it?" I prompted. "You're 18, I assume."
"Just turned."
He sipped his tea formally, as if he was measuring tablespoons in his mouth. "Because what I really want is to be able to describe your sister to our readers," I said. "Anne Nash's father is speaking about her, and I don't want Natalie to get lost in this story. Does your mother know you're speaking to me?"
"No, but it's okay. I think we'll have to agree to disagree about this."
His laugh came in a quick stutter.
"His mom is kind of a freak about the media," Meredith said, drinking from John's glass. "She's an extremely private person. I mean, I hardly think she even knows who I am, and we've been together for over a year, right?"
He nodded. She frowned, disappointed, I assumed, that he didn't add to the story of their romance. She removed her legs from his lap, crossed them, and began picking at the edge of the couch.
"And I hear you're living over with the Wheelers now?" "We have a place out back, a carriage house from the old days," Meredith said. "My little sister's pissed. It used to be the hangout for her and her nasty friends. Except for your sister. Your sister's cool. You know my sister, right, Kelsey?"
Of course. This piece of work would have connections to Emma.
"Kelsey tall or Kelsey small?" I asked.
"Totally. This town has way too many Kelseys. Mine's the tall one."
"I've met her. They seem close."
"They better be," Meredith said tightly. "Little Emma runs that school. Be a fool that got on her bad side." Enough about Emma, I thought. But images of her teasing lesser girls by those lockers bumped around in my head. Junior high is an ugly time.
"So, John, are you adjusting all right over there?"
"He's fine," Meredith snipped. "We put together a little care basket of guy stuff for him. My mom even got him a CD player."
"Oh, really?" I looked pointedly at John.
"Time to speak up, buddy. Don't be pussy-whipped on my time." "I just need to be away from home right now," he said. "We're all a little on edge, you know, and Natalie's stuff is everywhere. And my mom won't let anyone touch it. Her shoes are in the hallway, and her swimming suit is hanging in the bathroom we share, so I have to see it every morning I shower. I can't deal."
I can imagine. I could. I remember Marion's tiny pink coat hanging in the hall closet till I left for college. Might still be there. I turned on the tape recorder, pushed it across the table toward the boy. Tell me what your sister was like, John.
She was a nice kid. She was extremely smart. Just unbelievable.
Smart how? Like good in school or just bright?
Well, she didn't do that well in school. She had a bit of a discipline problem, he said. But I think it was just because she got bored. She should have skipped a grade or two, I think.
His mom thought it would stigmatize her, Meredith interjected. She was always worried about Natalie sticking out.
I raised my eyebrows at him. That's true. My mom really wanted Natalie to fit in. She was this sort of goofy kid, kind of a tomboy, and just kind of a weirdo.
He laughed, staring at his feet. Are you thinking of a particular story? I asked. Anecdotes are Curry's coin of the realm. Plus, I was interested.
Oh, like once she invented this whole other language, you know? And a regular kid, I mean, it'd be gibberish. But Natalie had the whole alphabet figured out. Looked like Russian. And she actually taught it to me. Or tried. She got frustrated with me pretty quickly.
He laughed again, that same croak, like it was coming up from underground. Did she like school?
Well, it's hard to be the new kid, and the girls here, well, I guess the girls anywhere can be a little bit snotty.
Johnny! Rude!
Meredith pretended to push him. He ignored her.
I mean, your sister, Emma, right? I nodded to him. She was actually friends with her for a little bit. They'd run around in the woods. Natalie'd come back all scraped up and daffy.
Really? Considering the scorn with which she'd mentioned Natalie's name, I couldn't picture it.
They were real intense for a little bit, but I think Emma got bored with her, Natalie being a few years younger. I don't know. They had some sort of falling out.
Emma learned that from her mother, the glib discarding of friends.
It was okay, though, John said, as if to reassure me, or him. She had one kid she played with a lot, James Capisi. Farm kid, a year or so younger that no one else talked to. They seemed to get along, though.
He says he's the last one to see Natalie alive, I said.
He's a liar, Meredith said. I heard that story, too. He's always made stuff up. I mean, his mom's dying of cancer. He's got no dad. He has no one to pay any attention to him. So he throws out that wild story. Don't listen to anything he says.
Again, I looked at John, who shrugged.
It is sort of a wild story, you know. A crazy lady snatches Natalie in broad daylight, he said. Besides, why would a woman do something like that?
Why would a man do something like that? I asked.
Who knows why men do such freaky stuff? Meredith added. It's a gene thing.
I have to ask you, John, have you been questioned by the police?
Along with both my parents.
And you have an alibi for the nights of both killings? I waited for a reaction, but he continued to sip his tea calmly.
Nope. I was out driving around. I just need to get out of here sometimes, you know.
He darted a quick glance at Meredith, whose lips pursed when she caught him looking.
It's just a smaller town than I'm used to. Sometimes you need to get lost for a little. I know you don't get it, Mare.
Meredith stayed silent.
I get it, I offered.
I remember getting very claustrophobic growing up here. I can't imagine what it must be like to move here from somewhere else.
Johnny's being noble, Meredith interrupted. He was with me both those nights. He just doesn't want to get me in trouble. Print that.
Meredith was wobbling on the edge of the sofa, stiff and upright and slightly disconnected, as if she were speaking in tongues.
Meredith, John murmured. No.
I'm not going to have people thinking my boyfriend is a fucking baby killer, thank you very much, John.
You tell that story to the police, and they'll know the truth in an hour. It will look even worse for me. No one really thinks I'd kill my own sister.
John took a single lock of Meredith's hair and pulled his fingers gently from the roots to the end. The word tickle flashed randomly from my right hip. I believed the boy. He cried in public and told silly stories about his sister and played with his girlfriend's hair, and I believed him. I could almost hear Curry snort at my naivete.
Speaking of stories, I started. I need to ask you about one. Is it true Natalie hurt one of her classmates back in Philadelphia?
John froze, turned to Meredith, and for the first time he looked unpleasant. He gave me a true image for the phrase, curled lips. His whole body jolted, and I thought he'd bolt for the door, but then he leaned back and took a breath.
Great. This is why my mom hates the media, he grumbled. There was an article about that in the paper back home. It was just a few paragraphs. It made Natalie sound like an animal.
So tell me what happened. He shrugged, picked at a nail.
It was an art class, and the kids were cutting and painting, and a little girl got hurt. Natalie was a little kid with a temper, and this girl was sort of always bossing Natalie around. And one time, Natalie happened to have scissors in her hand. It wasn't like a premeditated assault. I mean, she was 9 at the time.
I had a flash of Natalie, that serious child from the Keene family photo, wielding blades at a little girl's eyes. An image of bright red blood mingling unexpectedly with pastel watercolors. What happened to the little girl?
They saved her left eye. Her right was, ruined.
Natalie attacked both her eyes?
He stood up, pointing down at me from almost the same angle as his mother had. Natalie saw a shrink for a year after, dealing with this. Natalie woke up with nightmares for months. She was 9. It was an accident. We all felt horrible. My dad set up a fund for the little girl. We had to leave so Natalie could start over. That's why we had to come here. Dad took the first job he could find. We moved in the middle of the night like criminals. To this place. To this goddamn town.
Gee, John, I didn't realize you were having such a horrible time, Meredith murmured. He began to cry then, sitting back down, his head in his hands.
I didn't mean that I was sorry I came here. I meant I'm sorry she came here, because now she's dead. And we were trying to help. And she's dead.
He let out a quiet wail, and Meredith wrapped her arms grudgingly around him.
Someone killed my sister.
There would be no formal dinner that night, as Miss Adora wasn't feeling well, Gayla informed me. I assume it was my mother's affectation to request the Miss in front of her name, and I tried to imagine how the conversation might go. Gayla, the best servants in the best households call their mistresses by their formal names. We want to be the best, don't we? Something like that. Whether it was my argument with my mother or Emma's that was the cause of the trouble, I wasn't sure. I could hear them bickering like pretty birds in my mother's room, Adora accusing Emma correctly of having driven the golf cart without permission. Like all rural towns, Wind Gap has an obsession with machinery. Most homes own a car and a half for every occupant, the half being an antique collectible or an old piece of crap on blocks, depending on the income bracket. Plus boats, jet skis, scooters, tractors, and among the elite of Wind Gap, golf carts, which younger kids without licenses use to whip around town. Technically illegal, but no one ever stops them. I guessed my mother had tried to withhold this bit of freedom from Emma after the murders. I would have. Their fight squeaked on like an old seesaw for nearly half an hour,
Don't lie to me, little girl.
The warning was so familiar, it gave me an old feeling of unease. So Emma did occasionally get caught. When the phone rang, I picked up, just so Emma wouldn't lose her momentum, and was surprised to hear the cheerleader staccato of my old friend Katie Lacey. Angie Papermaker was having the girls over for a pity party. Drink a bunch of wine, watch a sad movie, cry, gossip. I should come. Angie lived in the new rich part of town, huge mansions at the outskirts of Wind Gap, practically Tennessee. I couldn't tell from Katie's voice if that made her jealous or smug. Knowing her, probably a bit of both. She'd always been one of those girls who wanted what anyone else had, even if she didn't want it. I knew when I saw Katie and her friends at the Keens home that I'd have to submit to at least one evening out. It was this, or finish transcribing my talk with John, which was making me dangerously sad. Plus, like Annabelle, Jackie, and that catty group of my mother's friends, this gathering was likely to yield more information than I'd get through a dozen formal interviews. As soon as she pulled up in front of the house, I realized that Katie Lacey, now Katie Brucker, had predictably done well for herself. I knew this both from the fact that it took her just 5 minutes to pick me up, turns out her home was but a block away, and what she picked me up in, one of those huge, stupid SUVs that cost more than some people's homes and provide just as many comforts. Behind my head, I could hear the DVD player tittering with some kids' show, despite the absence of kids. In front of me, the dashboard navigator was providing unnecessary play-by-play directions. Her husband, Brad Brucker, was studying at her father's feet, and when Daddy retired, he'd take over the business himself. They peddled a controversial hormone used to bulk up chickens with horrific rapidity. My mother always sniffed at this. She'd never use anything that put such a stunning rush on the growing process. That didn't mean she eschewed hormones. My mother's pigs were pricked with chemicals till they plumped and reddened like squirting cherries, till their legs couldn't support their juicy girth. But it was done at a more leisurely pace. Brad Brucker was the type of husband to live where Katie said, impregnate Katie when she asked, buy Katie the Pottery Barn sofa she wanted, and otherwise shut up. He was good-looking if you looked at him long enough, and he had a dick the size of my ring finger. This I knew firsthand, thanks to a slightly mechanical exchange my freshman year. But apparently the tiny thing worked fine. Katie was at the end of her first trimester for her third kid. They were going to keep trying till she had a boy. We really want a little rascal running around. Talk of me, Chicago, no husband yet, but fingers crossed. Talk of her, her hair, her new vitamin program, Brad, her two girls, Emma and Mackenzie, Wind Gap Ladies Auxiliary, and the horrible job they did with the St. Patrick's Day parade. Then sigh, those poor little girls. Yes, sigh, my story on those poor little girls. Apparently she didn't care that much, because she was quickly back to the Ladies Auxiliary and how scattered it had become now that Becca Hart, nay Mooney, was activities director. Becca was a girl of mid-tier popularity from our days, who shot to social stardom 5 years ago when she snagged Eric Hart, whose parents owned a sprawling go-kart, waterslide, mini-golf tourist trap in the ugliest part of the Ozarks. The situation was quite reproachable. She'd be there tonight, and I could see for myself. She just didn't fit in. Angie's house looked like a child's drawing of a mansion. It was so generic, it was barely three-dimensional. When I entered the room, I realized how much I didn't want to be there. There was Angie, who'd unnecessarily dropped 10 pounds since high school, and who smiled demurely at me and went back to setting out a fondue. There was Tish, who'd been the little mommy of the group, even back then, the one who held your hair when you threw up, and who had occasional dramatic crying jags about feeling unloved. She'd married a guy from Newcastle, I learned, a slightly dorky man,